Good afternoon. So last time we talked about some little topics about linking. Talked about how there were different kinds of relocations. So if you remember, relocations were those cases where the linker needed to fill in a blank. And when I first explained them, I said that that blank was an address, that we had like a jump to some function or a call to some function, and we wanted to know what the address of the function was in the machine code because that's what the processor actually expected. And that was kind of incomplete because sometimes the processor expects an address, and sometimes it might expect something that's computed from an address but not the address itself. For example, x86 has an instruction which says call a function that's 4,000 or whatever number of bytes away from this instruction. And the linker is responsible for filling in that 4,000 based on how the functions are actually laid out when it combines all the object files to produce the executable image. The other thing we mentioned is that the linking I showed you, the idea was we produced one memory image that the operating system could just load at the appropriate location, and that was what starting an executable was. Load the memory image, jump to the first instruction. But in many modern systems, we want to share code between multiple programs. Like, we don't want to have 1,000 copies of printf if we have 1,000 programs. We want to have one copy of printf. So we do part of the linking when we produce the programs themselves, and part when we start the programs, so we can have one version of printf that we load together and that we can update separately from all those 1,000 programs. And that was known as dynamic linking. The other kind of linking was known as static. And you can request static linking, but the default on most systems you've used is dynamic linking. We also talked about assembly. In particular, we talked about AT&T syntax, which is what our textbook uses, what we're going to use in future assignments in the course. And it's a bit different than the Intel syntax you're used to. And the biggest differences were that the destination goes last, including in cases when it seems problematic, like subtract. So subtract is subtract x from y in AT&T syntax, not what you're used to in Intel syntax. We also have this funny syntax for memory accesses, where we have an offset, a base register, an index register, and a scale. And this does the computation value of the base register plus value of the index register times the scale plus offset to compute an address, and then in the instruction typically fetches from that address to get a value. And we also briefly mentioned that when we have a jump where we use a register or location in memory to tell us where to go to, tell us what the next program counter should be, we have a star in AT&T syntax to represent that we have that indirection, that we're not actually executing machine code in RAX, we're using RAX to find the location of machine code to execute. And we mentioned LEA, which is, as I said, probably the most confusing instruction for students in this class in x86, which is load effective address. So it's basically does the same stuff a move would do, except we don't do the memory access. We just take the address we computed and put it in the destination register, rather than accessing a memory address we compute and putting what we accessed in the destination register. And then we went over some examples of using assembly, talking in particular about how comparisons work. So we went over if and do while to assembly using this trick of converting to if go to. And we talked about condition codes, which were about storing the last arithmetic result, which is how those conditional jump instructions work. It's not actually the case that you need to have a compare instruction right before a jump conditional instruction. Instead, compare instructions and arithmetic instructions set these condition codes, and that's what the conditional jump instructions read. So any questions about anything we covered before? Yes? So the question is, when would you use LEA versus move? So LEA's output, LEA performs a computation, and move accesses memory in this sense. Like, that's assuming you're passing the same parameters. So if you only want to perform a computation, like you want to compute what's the address of the 16th element of this array, you'd use LEA. If you want to access that, you'd use move. Yes? So move does the computations, but uses that to access memory. Like, so if you access the 16th element array, yes, it's going to compute the address, but it's not going to give you that address, it's going to give you what's there. Okay, other questions? Okay, so I'm going to start out with a logistical note. So if you remember, at the first lecture I talked about we have quizzes. So there will be a post-quiz starting after this lecture and a pre-quiz due before next lecture. And this will be our pattern for future weeks. And I'm going to show you what that looks like. So when you click the quizzes link at the top of our course webpage, you'll get to a page like this, except it will have more quizzes built in. And you'll see that we have an open date and a closed date and a time limit. So the time limit for all our quizzes will generally be 90 minutes. So you'll have 90 minutes from when you start them to finish them. There's an open date and a closed date. You have to finish it before the closed date. You can start any time after the open date. And to give an example of what it looks like, let's take this quiz 01 here. Should give a prompt. Okay, so I expected to get a confirmation, but I guess, but this is what the quiz interface will look like. So time is counting down, because we started it, and we have some questions. There's multiple choice, and sometimes select all and apply questions, and you select an answer, and it turns green. When it turns green, that means your answer is recorded. If it stays yellow, your answer has not been recorded, there's some network problem. And this means, for example, if I go back here, and then go back to my example quiz, I have my B recorded. There's a place for comments, so you can write some, some reasoning for your answer, and select a different answer, and we will be able to read your comments. So the quizzes will be graded automatically on the closing date. Sometime in the week following, we will have a TA read those comments and adjust the scores. They might adjust the score upwards or downwards, depending on what your comment says. So if you think the question is unclear, you can write a comment clarifying why you answered the way you did, and we'll look at that and decide whether you actually understood what was going on or you didn't, and adjust your score accordingly. Same thing true for select all and apply questions. So an important note about comments is that we randomize the order of the answer letters. So if you refer to an answer in your comments, please refer to it by like the text of the answer. Like if I want to refer to C here, I should you can copy and paste that text because it's different for every student and the person grading it won't have an easy way to figure out what order did we show you these in. So that's what taking a quiz looks like. And after you take a quiz, you can go, after the closing time, you can go back to the quiz page and you'll see it graded. So we have our score on the question up here and the mean score of everyone in the class. In this case, my class is one person. And the score on the question here and the mean score of everyone in the class. We also have percentages next to each answer, which is the percent of students which gave that answer. In this case, there's one person, so the percentages are very boring. And we have the correct answers marked. So for select all that apply, every answer that you need to mark is marked as correct. The way grading works for a single option question is it's all or nothing. If you select the correct answer, you get a point. If you don't, you get 0 points. For a select all that apply question, each part is a separate sub-question. So in this case, I didn't select A, which was an answer I should have selected, so I didn't get a third of a point. I didn't select B, which was something I should have selected, so I got a third of a point. And I selected C, which I shouldn't have, so I didn't get a third of a point, so I got one third of a point for question two. Yes? Mm-hmm.
So it only marks one of the correct answers?
So if multiple of these answers were correct, we mark multiple of them or you list it as correct answer for the select all. Yes?
How many questions are
there
usually on the quizzes?
How many questions are there usually on the quizzes? So probably order 5. 4 to 6 is probably typical. So any other questions about quizzes? I guess I should note, so this shows the scores and correct answers. If you made comments, which might change how we score things, immediately after the quiz closes, those won't be taken into account. They'll just have been auto-graded. Some TA actually has to look at it in that. And when that happens, your comment will appear here along with the reply from the TA about how that affected your grade. So I note that sometimes we make mistakes in writing the quiz questions or making the keys for the quiz questions. If so, we'll update the keys for everyone. I'm sorry that might happen. We'll try to avoid it, but we had a few cases last semester where we didn't realize we had the wrong answer marked as correct or something like that. If you think something's wrong, let us know. We can make changes. Yeah. Are comments required? No. If you can get the right answers without putting comments, which is typically the case, you don't need to write any comments. You should write comments if you think that question's ambiguous or something like that. And in that case, if you had interpretation which didn't match ours because you thought it was ambiguous, then you might get credit. If you write a comment which shows that you don't know understand what's going on, you might lose credit, even if you happen to guess the right answer. So no more questions about quizzes? Okay, so first quiz is released at 7 p.m. tonight. They're all listed on the calendar, so you can find them. And there's one, so the first quiz is released 7 p.m. tonight, due Monday afternoon. And the pre-quiz for next week, which is on the reading, which is listed on the title of the quiz when you go to the quiz page, if you don't want to look it up in the schedule, is due before the first lecture, so at 10:45 a.m. on Tuesday, and will be released on Saturday. So that's before the first lecture, because I don't want people in my first lecture doing the quiz during lecture. So I'm sorry that I don't give you the extra 2 hours.
On the schedule, you have your lecture and then the readings.
Yeah.
Are those the readings to be read by that day, or to?
These are the readings we will cover on that day. So the pre-quiz is on the readings for the lectures in the week before. So, for example, the pre-quiz for next week, before it, you should read everything that's listed as a reading on next Tuesday and next Thursday.
Okay.
And there happens to be no readings for next Tuesday, but there are for next Thursday. Other questions? So last time when we finished up, we were talking about condition codes. And I mentioned this is how XE6 does conditional jumps and so on. So there are these special registers that don't have a normal register name. They're set by almost all arithmetic instructions and store information about the last arithmetic result. The information they store is basically, was it 0, was it negative? And our conditional instructions are named based on interpreting the result of doing a subtraction. So jump equal is actually, was the last arithmetic result 0? Jump less than is, was the last arithmetic result less than 0? And so on. And we mentioned last time that, we have these special arithmetic instructions, so comp was one of them. So compare is just a subtraction that forgets to write its result to a register, to a normal register. It does the subtraction, sets the condition codes, but forgets to store the result to a register. We also have an instruction test, which does the same thing with bitwise AND. We'll learn later on what bitwise AND is. But the important thing is test REX, REX. The result is REX, which is what compilers sometimes generate. Okay. And I believe we finished up last time by pointing out that since we set condition codes this way, condition codes by arithmetic operations, we had our example of turning a do-while loop into assembly. And we did this thing here where we subtracted 1 from R12 and then compared R12 to 0. But we know the comparison instruction just subtracts 0 from R12 and looks at the result. And that result's going to be the same thing as when we subtract 1 from R12 the first time. So we can just omit that compare, and the subtract instruction just sets the condition codes right already in this case. And if you look at code compilers generate, they know this, and they will do this. They'll say, oh, I'm already computing the right value. I don't need to compare to 0. The condition codes are already set, and they'll take advantage of this. And this gives you an idea of why the designers of the x86 instruction set decided we're going to have these condition codes that every arithmetic operation sets, rather than we're going to only have them set by these comparison instructions. The idea is you can just do computations you need to do anyways, like decrementing a counter, and that will compute the things that the conditional jump instructions need. And in fact, compilers are pretty good at doing this. And condition codes really are set by all arithmetic instructions. So all the examples I showed you so far, we've done subtractions, but it really is the case that all of them do it. So for example, if I have 20 in RBX, I add negative 20 to it, the result is 0. 0, if we had a subtraction, would mean the two numbers were equal. So that sets the condition codes the same way as subtracting and getting 0. That means that if you do a jump equals, it's going to jump, because the condition codes are set saying the result was 0. That's what means equals, even though 20 and negative 20 aren't equal. That's not what it's checking. It's checking, was the result equal to 0? That's what jump equals checks. So any questions on this part of condition codes? So I've said that almost all arithmetic instructions set condition codes, and we had some which only do it. There are some instructions which don't. The two most notable ones that you might think would set condition codes but don't are LEA and move. So this is a way in which doing an LEA to add two numbers together and using add to add two numbers together are different. So add sets the condition codes, LEA doesn't. And move never does. And this is an arbitrary rule. The way you find this out is by looking up in Intel's documentation what instructions set condition codes. There's nothing about LEA or move which says they're not arithmetic enough inherently that they shouldn't set condition codes. This is a decision the x86 designers made, that they could have just as easily decided LEA and move are going to set condition codes. And also, all our control flow instructions, more obviously, because you don't think of them as computing things, don't set condition codes. And by don't set condition codes, I don't mean that the condition codes are, reset to a default state. I mean they're left unchanged. So for example here, we set RBX to 20. We subtract 20 from it by adding negative 20, get 0. That sets the condition codes to say the result was 0. If we then move 1 into RAX, that doesn't change the condition codes. They're set based on the add instruction and stay that way. So all the instructions that don't set it, they just leave it unchanged. Even if we get rid of the original values that were, added or subtracted, like, we still have these condition codes stored in a separate place to remember what the result was. So any questions about this? So let's apply these condition codes to a few more examples of converting loops to assembly. So here I have a while loop. So this is different than my do while loop. So what's a good first step if I want to write assembly for this? Yeah?
Write the C go-to version.
Okay, so write a C version using go-to and if go-to, because that way we will have something where we can look at each line and it's just blindly translate it to assembly. So the most straightforward way of doing this is like so. So we have, if the condition is not true, so I wrote this, which is equivalent to not of x greater than or equal to 0, then skip the loop, otherwise call foo, decrement x, go to the beginning, check again, do you want to do another iteration of the loop, and so on. This is probably the most straightforward way. I would note that there are other things I could have written which are equivalent, so this is not the only way of translating it to assembly. So once I have that, I can just translate it line by line into assembly. So I can say, if x less than 0 go to, I can translate that into this pair of instructions here. Compare 12 to 0, jump less than, just skip the loop, and then call foo. Calling foo is just a call instruction. Subtracting 1 from x is just a subtract instruction, and then I jump to the beginning to translate my go-to. So any questions about what I did here? Makes sense. Something you could say do on an exam. Okay. So if everyone's comfortable, let's go to an example here. So here I have a different while loop. And I'm going to say that I put b in rbx, and we'll say that's callee saved, so I don't need to worry about calling foo, overriding my register value. And I have three things which are close to being a translation of this while loop. And so which of them are actually a translation? They're all close. They're all things where we can make a pretty small change, and it's actually going to be a version of the while loop. But not all of them are actually correct. So you can decide amongst talk amongst yourselves to figure out if you agree. Give you a few minutes to look at it. I would recommend writing things down, but you don't have to. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so does anyone want to volunteer a reason why any one of these is not a correct translation? Okay, back there. Yeah, so version A, the question is, what if say B equals 20? Then in that case, we're going to call foo one more time than we're supposed to. So the thing which is missing here is that we probably want to go to the comparison first. So if we like add a jump middle at the end and a label middle at the compare, I think that's actually correct then. But that's what we're missing there. So another version people, any other version people would like to volunteer is wrong? Yes.
Version C is wrong.
Okay.
Because it does the wrong comparison. It checks if B is less than 10, then it will end the loop.
Okay.
Actually, I think it checks if B is less than or equal to 10. Because what does it moves 10 to RAX.
Yeah.
It subtracts B from 10.
So this computes 10 minus B, and greater than or equal to is greater than or equal to 0.
Yeah.
Which is?
Asking B is less than or equal to 10.
Yeah.
So if you add, say, like a value of B is 5, the loop should continue. But this loop would.
Yeah, so well, so the fix is that this is, shouldn't be j greater than or equal to.
It should be j less than.
Probably j. Yeah. So we have the wrong type of comparison. And this is tricky because this depends on that thing I told you at AT&T Syntax earlier about subtracts being subtract x from y, not maybe not what you expected. If you thought it was the other way, it actually would be right. And version B, I believe, is correct. It's probably the most straightforward translation. But we see we have these other versions of the loop which you can make. And all of them are things that you might imagine your compiler generating. So any questions about any of these versions before?
So if you have like compare Rx to Rbx, like this, that doesn't trump.
Yeah.
If you have like compare Rx to Rbx followed by jump if greater than.
Yeah.
It'll jump if RBX is greater than RAX.
If you have compare RAX, RBX.
Yeah.
So this computes RBX minus RAX. If you ask for jump greater than, that's is this greater than or equal to zero, which is the same as is RBX greater than or equal to RAX, yes.
So
it flips the order versus what you're used to from Intel syntax. I usually just do the subtraction because that always gets me, because that's more consistent for me to think about it rather than thinking it flips it. Also because I need to worry about like there being an add instruction instead, but if you want to think about it as flipping order, that's fine. Yeah. So we'll talk about the actual flags, but it checks if it was zero or greater than zero. Yes. Which, as we'll learn, there's a flag for if it's zero and a flag for if it's negative. A bit for that. But we haven't actually talked about that. We just kind of glossed over how do we actually store what we need to store. Other questions about this? Okay. So that was our loop. So something noting is that when you see real compiled code, compilers will do different things. So for this loop, I can get a real compiler. This is real compiler output, except I may have changed the register so RBX is used for B consistently. Other than that, this is real compiled code. So this is one thing I can get my compiler to generate. If I pass some slightly different options about optimization, I can get this version. And if I pass even more different things about optimization, I can get that version. And it's not obvious, especially for the last one, but these are all equivalent. So first of all, why is my compiler generating these different versions? What might the advantage be of, say, generating the second version rather than the more straightforward first version? Yes?
For safety.
For safety. So what might be safer about the first version, second version, or the first version?
I guess the second version.
So you think maybe the compiler wants to take more space?
Well,
so
it's guaranteed to compile
So these are both actually correct translations. There's nothing, they're both completely correct and will produce the same answer always. Like they're actually equivalent in that sense. There's not some like corner case where sometimes something overflows and that causes the problem. No, there's nothing like that. Yes?
Does that have to do with compile time? Like how long it takes to compile?
So one question is maybe it has to do with compile time. So maybe one of these is faster to compile. But why wouldn't we always do the fastest thing? What is the compiler gaining by spending more time?
Optimizing further.
Okay, so what do you think is more optimized?
The
leftmost one, you think is, okay. Because it's shorter?
Yeah.
Any other opinions way back there?
The second one compared to the first one, there are less instructions inside of the loop. So if you're iterating a bunch of times, less instructions there.
Yes, so it looks like the first one is the more optimized one, and if we're optimizing for size, which I think might have been what I asked the compiler to do in that case, that is true. But the second version has less instructions run in the loop, so maybe it's faster? And that's probably the reason the compiler would generate that, because it has less instructions in the loop, so it might be faster. So it added some extra instructions at the beginning in order to get rid of this one single instruction from our loop. So it reorganized things to do that. So, question?
Just like another comment.
Yeah.
But the first one uses the jump greater than equal to like every loop, but then the other two use the jump not equal to. Is that conditional jump like easier to use if you only
detect
one flag?
So the question is jump not equal faster or better than jump greater than? I don't actually know. I wouldn't be surprised if it were faster, but I'm not convinced there's a good reason for it to be. Okay, so how about the last version? Why would the compiler generate that version? Yes. Okay. So maybe the decorand instruction is faster than adding. Okay, that's a possibility. There's an ink instruction, so yes. But yes, it might be faster. There's something more going on. The deck instruction being faster is probably a factor, but there's something else going on. Yeah.
This one has even fewer instructions, like within the looping part. This one only has two instructions per loop.
Yeah, so probably the thing the compiler is doing, it's less about the deck instruction being there is probably something, and maybe the compiler in the previous version should have generated an ink instruction. But the big thing is that we've eliminated another instruction from this loop. So the loop is as short as it can possibly be. But we did a lot of work to do that. And can anyone describe what is the compiler doing before start loop there? Why? What is that assembly meant to do? It's not intuitive. So, yeah, it's back there. Yeah, so we compute b prime, which is 10 minus b. And decrementing b prime is the same thing as incrementing b. So we're in the loop, we're actually dealing with this b prime, which is always equal to 10 minus b. And that transformation is done just during the loop, just so we can remove another instruction from the loop. That's something that compiler does when I tell it to optimize a lot. So it's making the loop real short on the hopes that despite all the setup code above the loop, that this will be faster. So these are all things you might see compilers do. They have all these heuristics about how to make loops work better. So, you know, all things you might see in the bomb lab. There's not just one way of translating a loop. And compilers do frequently really take advantage of the condition codes being set by normal arithmetic instructions and seem to go through quite some effort to do so. which is really the big advantage here. So more so than the decrement maybe being faster is that the decrement sets the condition codes right for us to use J and E, which otherwise we had to have a compare. Okay, so any questions about any of these? Okay, so mentioning condition codes, let's talk more concretely about how they're stored. So in x86 stores condition codes in basically a set of 1-bit registers. And one of those is called ZF for zero flag. And that says, was the result of the last arithmetic zero? This is what corresponds to jump equal. Another one is called SF for the sign flag, which says, was the result negative? So the name sign flag comes because we can take our result, just copy the sign bit into this 1-bit register. So it's whatever the sign bit of the last arithmetic result was. There are some extra condition codes that we will, for the most part, not talk about in this course. In particular, our textbook talks about them, but we're not going to have you implement them when we have you implement a subset of x86. And the most notable thing these deal with is overflow. So like when you compare int max and int min, you would like to actually find out that int max is greater than int min and not something else. So there are extra condition codes to make this happen. And so those are something we're not going to talk about, we're not going to implement, but you really want them on a processor because you would be rather annoyed if comparisons didn't work with int min correctly. You expect that to happen, and you would be very bad if the compiler had to go through extra work every time you compare two integers just in case it's int min or long min or something like that. So in GDB, you can see these as part of the eflags register. So if you do info regs in GDB, you'll see eflags, probably some value, and something like sf. If you see that, that means the sf flag is set. This is set to 1, zf must be set to 0. Yes?
What's GDB?
What's GDB?
Yeah.
The GNU debugger?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What most of you are probably using for the lab and homework. So, as an example, you take our computing here, taking 20 minus negative 10 to get 30. That's not negative, so after we do that, the sign flag will be 0. We'll copy the 0 from the sign bit into the sign flag, indicating it's not negative. And the 0 flag will be 0 because it's not 0. So that's how that sets the condition codes, and jump less than equal is checking, is the 0 flag set or is the sign flag set? And neither of those are true. If we look at another example here, we add negative 20 and 20, we get 0. So that sets the sign flag to 0 because the sign bit is 0. It's not negative. That sets the 0 flag to 1 because it is 0. This move instruction then leaves SF and ZF unchanged. And then jump equal checks, is the 0 flag set to 1? If so, I'm going to jump. So any questions about these examples? So I will very briefly mention the other two flags our textbook talks about a bit. So there's a carry flag and an overflow flag. And these both just say, did a computation overflow? The carry flag is, did it overflow as unsigned? The overflow flag is, did it overflow as signed? So we have one for signed and unsigned. This means that you might see in the bomb lab, well, something like, JA, JAE, JB, JBE. Who saw one of these instructions? So these are conditional jumps that are unsigned. So A stands for above, B for below. So JA works like J greater than, except it's different in how it deals with overflow. It checks for unsigned. It does the right thing for unsigned versus signed as far as how it handles overflow in the computation. And jump below is like less than, except does the right thing for unsigned and how it handles overflow. Yes?
What do you mean by add sign and
add sign? So they handle overflow in a way where if you compare two values, they act as if the registers are unsigned longs. Okay. Whereas the less than acts as if they're signed longs, as far as what they do for like long max. So we're not going to talk about what you need to do to make that happen in this class, which I think you can figure out because you learn number representation, but it's just not something we're going to spend time dealing with. And for the Y86, our textbook Y86 has the overflow flag, so it can do signed comparisons, but not unsigned ones. But we're not going to implement it. We're just going to say, if you compare things with long max, sorry, you're going to get the wrong answer. Okay, so any questions about condition codes or translating C to assembly before I move on to our next topic, which is talking a little bit about C? Okay. So, so C, as I mentioned in the first class, is a subset of C++. So for the most part, everything you learned in 2150 is going to apply. So this should be familiar probably from 2150. Like in C++, the sizes of these types vary between machines, but these are the sizes that are going to be on our lab machines. So they're the sizes we're going to be concerned with in this course. Like in C++, we also have unsigned versions of each of these. We have unsigned char, unsigned short, and so on of each of these. But this is most of the basic types in C. We also have something which is kind of like classes called structs, but they aren't the same as classes. They're different in some very significant ways. For example, they don't have methods. But we don't have what you're used to as classes in C++. Those just don't exist in C. So any questions about any of these types? Sizes? Sense. So there's one notable omission from this, which is, yeah.
What is
anything? Anything means any type, like short, long, struct types it will turn out, void star is a valid thing to put in there, so on. Any pointer type is going to be 8 bytes on our lab machines. Okay, so those are our data types. They're basically the same as C++. We just don't have classes. We'll talk about structs probably Tuesday, which are basically classes without methods, but have slightly different syntax than what you're used to. So a notable omission is I don't have a bool there. So you're used to a Boolean type. There is effectively no Boolean type in C. You might learn, there is kind of one in the most recent version of C, but it's not called what you think it is, and it doesn't work the way you're used to Boolean types working. In particular, the most important thing which makes me say there's not really a Boolean type is I do x equals 4, that returns an int. You would expect it to return some sort of Boolean type, it returns an int. That's just the rule. It always returns an int. This is also true of every other logical operator. So greater than, double ampersand, and so on, all return ints. And that int is going to be 1 if the result is true, 0 if it's false. So, question?
I think in the last semester of going to some of the research assemblies and labs, we found that rules took up 4 bytes or something like that. Does that happen?
So the question is, doesn't this have anything to do with, so I know on some systems, bools in C++ are 4 bytes. Does it have anything to do with it? So the likely reason, I'm not sure, the likely reason to choose ints is ints are supposed to be the most natural size on the machine, is usually the idea. And the reason to use ints and not some like short or char, even though it takes up less space, is that when you're working in registers, you prefer to work with the size of the register. And that's probably the reason the designers of C chose to make the result an int. And probably similar considerations might make you want to make a bool the same size. But there's no requirement for a C++ bool to be that size. And I certainly could imagine systems where it's smaller. Yes?
But ints are 4 bytes, aren't registers larger?
So aren't registers larger? Yes. I'm saying this was the, so this was roughly the size at the time that C was being designed. Was typically the int would be chosen to be the size of the register. This is less true now because it kind of makes less sense to have 64-bit ints. But back when C was being designed, that size of a register typically meant your int would be 16 or 32 bits, depending on what your register size in the machine was. Yes?
So what is the truth value if it's not 0 or 1?
The question is, what is the truth value if it's not 0 or 1? I have the answer to that on the next slide. So let's go there. So here is the exhaustive, complete list of false values in C. Every other value is true. So 0 is false, and this includes 0 cast to a pointer, which is a null pointer. That is false. Everything else is true. Yes?
Does that mean we can compare a null pointer to 0?
You can compare a pointer to 0. What that means is that doing if pointer equals equals, or let's do not equals 0. So if pointer not equals 0 is the same as doing if pointer. That's what it means.
How about null?
And it's the same as doing if pointer not equal null.
Okay.
They're all equivalent. Yes.
So if you do, so you had some int that wasn't 1 and you do not on it, that would be
0.
To 0.
Yes. So if you have an int that's not 1, for example, you have an int that's negative 1, and you do exclamation point that int, you get a 0.
Okay.
So this means, for example, that negative values are true, which is maybe the most non-intuitive part of this for some people.
Pointers, do you say?
Pointers, if they're not, null pointers are 0 pointers, basically. So they're false. All other pointers are true. Okay. So that's, yeah, so that's what those other values do. Okay. And so I talked about logical operators returning 0 or 1. There's something else special about logical operators that most people in this class don't know, I'd like to talk about, which is happens to also be true in C++ and Java, it just doesn't come up. So here I have some code. We haven't talked about printf, we'll talk about it more next time, but what this does is it prints out a open, a greater than sign, followed by a number, that's what the %d stands for, and the number is the result of this. So 0 or 1, depending on whether the OR is true or false. So that's what this code does, and we have a function called 0, which prints out 0, and then returns 0. We have a function called 1, which prints out 1, and then returns 1. And I have here the output of this program. It outputs 0, it outputs 1, and then it outputs 1, the result of the first 0 OR. Then it outputs 1, and then the result of the first comparison. And I'm not missing a line in this output. This is the actual output you will get every time, no matter how you compile this program. So this is known as short circuiting. So what happens here is ordinarily, we went to evaluate our double pipe operator or logical OR. So we go from left to right. The rule is it always goes from left to right. That's required. The compiler cannot choose to do something else. So we take the left side. We evaluate that. In this case, we call the zero function, which prints out zero. And then we get a result, which is, in this case, a false value. And we look at our truth table for OR, and we say, OK, it's false. So it's either going to be false or true. I need to keep going. So we then evaluate the other side, the right-hand side. We call the one function, which prints out one. It returns one. One is true, so we're going to end up with a result of true, which is the number one. And that's how we get our result. In the second case, we go from left to right again. So we call the one function to evaluate the left side. It prints out one and returns one. One is true. We look at this side of the truth table and we say, oh, the only possible result is true. I'm done. And since the only possible result is true and we're done, we don't even bother to evaluate the other side. And we just return that the result of the comparison is one. We just don't even call that zero function on the other side. So this behavior is not an optimization. It is mandatory. It is also mandatory in C++ and Java. The compiler must not call zero and also must call from left to right. It cannot evaluate it in another order. That's not allowed. This is just how the logical OR operator works in C, C++, and Java. Yes?
So the takeaway is just that
validate
OR, you check the left side first, and if it's true, just don't check the right side.
Yeah, so yes, when you evaluate OR, you check the left side. If it's true, you're done. You don't check the right side. This is how it's required to work. This means, for example, that the way logical OR is implemented is not by like taking two values and doing an actual OR operation on them, but it's going to be implemented with conditional jumps. Because the compiler kind of has to do that. It has to skip over a function call. Yeah?
Is that different from the comparison where you just have one vertical line?
So the question is, what about the case where you have one vertical line? Does that do something different? Yes. We will talk about it's more different than just evaluating always both sides. It's even more different than that. We will talk about that sometime later. Okay, so the short circuiting, this stopping early, also happens for the logical AND operator. So in this case, we have zero. We look at zero and we say, okay, so that's false. I look at my truth table. The only possible result is false. I'm done. So in that case, we return zero without ever calling the one function in that line. In the other case, we have the one side first. We look at our truth table. It could be false. It could be true. So we need to keep going. We call zero. We find out it's actually false. And then that's how we find out to output zero. So any questions about short circuiting? Yeah. So we'll talk later about the single ampersand and single OR operators, which are very different, and not just in what they evaluate. Okay. So one thing which is mostly review, but a bit different than C++, so we'll go over it, is how strings in C work. So there is no string type in C. Instead, we use pointers to character arrays. And the convention is that we have a zero character that's backslash zero, so that's the character with value zero, so the byte is zero. It's not the letter zero in ASCII, it's ASCII code zero. And that tells us where the end of the string is. If you want to put the byte zero in the middle of a string in C, for this style of string, you can't do it. You need to use some other kind of data structure. So here we have a constant string, which is going to be presumed probably in read-only data in our program. And we've asked for a pointer to it, I've marked the pointer as a pointer to a const char. So I'm saying I'm not going to change the thing that it points to. And I've assigned the pointer to point to this constant string, and that means I get it to point to the first character of that string. That's how we're going to represent it. Okay. And that pointer is, of course, going to be in a register or on our stack because it's a local variable. So I can do arithmetic with that pointer. So in 2150, you probably like use pointers to access arrays, but pointers really, really act like addresses. So we can add things to pointers to adjust the addresses they contain. So if I add 0 to hello, I get what I started with. Adding 0 doesn't do anything. If I add 5, I advance by 5 characters. So I start with a pointer to the capital H. I end up with a pointer to the first space. And this is basically just adding 5 to the address. That's what the compiler will generate when you write hello plus 5, where hello is this char pointer. And you can, of course, dereference these pointers. So I can dereference hello plus 0 and get the H that's there. I can dereference the hello plus 5 and get the space that's there. And this is equivalent to doing the array index notation. In fact, the array index notation is just a shorthand for doing this pointer manipulation. They're exactly the same. So any questions about what you see here? Yes.
So if you have it for a different data type, you don't have to adjust for the different size.
So the question is, what about a different data type? Yes, the C will make this work. We'll talk about what that means in a second. I started with chars where there's no adjustment to make because they're 1 byte. Okay. So in C, it's the case that if you do star foo plus bar, that's exactly the same as foo at bar. And this is true even if foo is an array. The array will what is called decay into a pointer. So the compiler will turn it into a pointer when you're trying to use it in a way you can use a pointer. And this is really, really true, you know, even in cases where you think it wouldn't make sense. So this means that if I have a pointer to somewhere in the middle of an array, I can still use this subscript notation. It works, it's just equivalent to adding to that thing in the middle, and so on. It doesn't matter whether it points to an array or not. Points to the beginning of an array or not, you can always use this notation. It just always adds to the address and gets there. And if you go out of bounds with this, well, probably the compiler will generate code to access memory you're not supposed to and your program might crash. Yes?
So what do you mean that it decays into a pointer?
So if I have an array, what I mean is that it decays into a pointer, if I have an array like foo10, when I try to do something which needs a pointer with foo like this or like plus 13, it will convert, the compiler will convert foo to a pointer to its first element, even though that's a different type than what foo is.
So you can use the bracket notation on any pointer?
Yes, so you can use the bracket notation on any pointer. It always translates that way. It's really, and see, it's exactly equivalent. Yes?
Can you use bracket notation on a void pointer,
is the question. So the answer is no, and the reason why is that if you have a void pointer, doing v plus 1 is basically an error. Some compilers will treat it like a char pointer, but it's not consistent and basically an error. Yeah.
So in C++, the string C++, does it contain character array as a field?
So the question is, the C++ string, does it contain a character array as a field? Maybe. Part of the joy of using classes for that is that there's flexibility in how it's implemented. So any other questions about this equivalence? And that you can do arithmetic on pointers and arrays that get turned into pointers. Okay, so I mentioned earlier, I was asked, what about non-bytes? Like, doesn't that mean that when we add two, if it's actually equivalent, we need to do something different, and that in fact works. So here I have an array of ints, those are 4 bytes in my system. I get a pointer to the first one. So my pointer initially points here. And then I set it to that element to 20 through the pointer. And then I advance my pointer by 2. That's going to advance by 2 array elements, which means that we're going to advance by 8 in this case. So the compiler is going to generate code that does something like add Q 8 to wherever, whatever register we have the pointer stored in. And it's just going to do that scaling for you automatically and make the pointer point to, in this case, 12. Then we modify through the pointer to get 30 there and end up changing the array in that way. Yes?
The first index changed to 20
because of line 4. So the pointer pointed to the first element of the array at that point in time, and was changed there. Okay. So other questions on this example? And so this holds true in general. So whatever type the pointer points to, when you do, if you have a T star Q, and you do Q plus equals K, the compiler will add K times size of T to the address. And the same thing will happen with subtraction. It's always scaled by the size of the value being pointed to. So you need to have a pointer to the appropriate kind of type. But it will work out doing adjusting things as if you had an array of those values. Yes?
On line 5, if you were explicit about like the size, like 2 times size of it, would it do the scaling twice, or did it just...
So the question is, if I wrote pointer equals plus 2 times size of int, would that do the scaling twice? Yes. This would advance by, be the same as plus 8. It would advance 8 array elements, so you'd get a pointer over here, which you probably don't want to access. Yeah, so generally, you should not be doing the scaling yourself. It's done for you. Unless you are like working with unsigned care pointers to access an integer array, don't do it. Yes? So the question is, what happens if you move the pointer, a pointer outside the array you started with? And the answer is, you may or may not get an out of bounds error. Okay. Don't count on it. You might accidentally overwrite important memory even and have something really weird happen. Yes?
So if I have a pointer as a car pointer, and I set it to pointer, first of all, is that allowed?
So the question is, could I make a car pointer that points to the beginning of this array? And the answer is yes, you might need a cast.
And then if I were to access at a certain index,
So the question is, so if I make a char pointer to this, the beginning of this array by casting from the int pointer, and then I access things with indexes in that char pointer, what scaling is it based on? It's based on chars because it's the pointer type. So it's always based on the type you declared your pointer, how the scaling works, not based on what you actually allocated that it points to. You can always look at the type of the pointer, not the type of the thing it points to. The compiler doesn't bother figuring out what it points to when it does the scaling. It just looks at how you declared it. Other questions? Okay, so a brief note on precedence. So ampersand foo at one takes the address of element one of foo. It does not take the address of foo and then treat that as an array and access element one of that. Star of foo at one dereferences the first element in foo. And this is also true if, for example, we have like, more importantly, if we have like 3 here. So if you wanted to dereference the pointer first, you need to use parentheses. This comes up a bit on the homework we'll have next week, which is the main reason I'm mentioning it. So this is just precedence. As usually is the case in precedence, if you have doubts, add parentheses. You'll never get the wrong answer by adding parentheses. Also, similarly, if you do star foo plus plus, that is foo plus plus dereference that. So this increments the pointer and then returns the value stored where it was originally pointing. And if you're confused by that, I don't recommend writing this code, but you might read code like this. That's what it's doing. So foo plus plus increments the pointer, not the value being pointed to, even with a star in front of it. Yes?
So first one would return foo plus plus, the address that foo is saying to plus one.
The first line here? Yeah, so this is foo plus, so this is equivalent to foo plus one. And this here is equivalent to star foo plus three. If I have a three there. And this basically is equivalent to int star temp equals foo, foo plus equals one, and return temp. I'm sorry, return star temp, I should say. That's important. Any questions on these? Yes? Because the, why do we need two asterisks? So there's one for the one on the outside and one for this translation. So first I translate the brackets, bracket three, and then I add the asterisk that's actually written down. Any other questions? Okay, so let's finish up with a little exercise. So first a note on this declaration here. So here, I'm declaring an array that gets stored on the stack. So this is array on the stack. Which is initially set to a string. So the string is copied. The string here, this is copy string to stack. So this is different than if I did char star foo equals the string. That would be pointer on the stack pointing to original string, which we wouldn't be able to modify. So here we make, because we're declaring an array, it's an array on the stack, so we can modify it. It's not going to affect the original string. We don't have to worry about anything like that. which is unlike what I showed you earlier, where we had a pointer to possibly read-only data, because it's the copy of that constant, like we call the function again, we'll get the same thing. So you couldn't modify it. So here, this declaration makes a copy of the string foo on the stack. So the modification is not a reason it would crash. So given that, what does this code do? And which of these answers is correct? So discuss amongst yourselves. You might write things down. Yeah. Foo is an array, not a pointer. It will be turned into a pointer when needed, but there's no pointer stored on the stack. There's just four values. The compiler will make a pointer to the array when you need one.
What goes down if you modify the backslash zero character
you put
at the end of
the
string?
So the question is, what happens if I modify the backslash zero?
Yeah.
When you modify it itself, nothing. If you try to use something which expects it to be there, then you could go over the end of the array, for example.
What function would you expect it to be there?
Any function which like prints out a string. And there's C library functions that manipulate strings. They'll expect it. Yeah. So anyone need more time? Okay, so given that, who thinks the answer is A, B, C, D, E? Okay, so we're pretty unanimous in agreement. So I have my brief explanation. So as I said, foo is on the stack. And what I mean by that is that we have the actual characters, four characters on the stack, not a pointer. So we initially set the pointer to point at the beginning, we change that to a B, we make the pointer, advance the pointer by two characters to point to the last O. Then we use this funny syntax where I probably should have written star pointer instead of pointer at zero, but they're both the same, to set that to Z. And then I use this funny syntax where I probably should have written foo at one to set that, set the middle character to A. Yes?
When you allocate a space for an array using brackets, does it automatically set everything in that space to backslash zero and then go back over it and change?
So the question is, when you allocate space in an array, if I don't specify what the value is that set to zero? No. If you specify part of it to have a value in the place where you declare it, define it, the rest will be set to zero, but otherwise, no. Yes?
So if we use the other syntax for declaring the string key, one where it's like star foo.
Yeah. So if we did char star foo equals foo, then we'd have foo is a pointer, which points to FOO in the data segment. And when we try to modify this, this might be read only. Because it's the copy of foo that's used every time we call the functions is the same thing as part of the constant data in our program.
So this syntax
makes a copy to work with.
The one written in red is not as flexible.
Yeah, so it doesn't let you change it. It doesn't give you your own copy. On the other hand, the thing it's pointing to will stick around after the function returns. Like the one here, it's an array, it goes away when the function returns. That's all I have for today. I'll take questions. Remember that there's a quiz, and so on.